interested in meeting women and did you find out later on years that they were homosexual or did you sense the end of the time?
Well, I sensed that there was something different about them. Because I would show a picture of a boyfriend or I would talk about some fellow I knew that was going into service, and then they would meet, or you exchange pictures and wallets, and one maybe would have their purse or pull, we use wallets, and you'd see a picture of a whack or a wave, or like Burke said, somebody's got to drive the buses. And then I noticed that there was one girl from the aircraft, not where I worked, she was working in a little company I worked for afterward when I thought I could go back into it, a Harding aircraft, or they just made little tiny parts on a bench. And she was working at Harding, and I had met her when she worked at Vega, and she said to me, Harding's really easy, it's a nice little plant, no noise, you just sit on a bench and do a little bench work if you ever want to leave here and come there. But she and Burke, got that name. Okay, she and Margaret were always, she was always, even, sometimes when she wasn't working, after she left the aircraft, I'd see her on the bus and she'd ride back and forth and I'd say, don't you ever get off this bus? But she was always, riding up with me. And then we met one time at the beach and there they were together and they were, and I said to them, hey, you guys act like you're, like you're married or something. And they handed me a book, all wrapped up in a nice package with a ribbon on it. And they said, yeah, you have a lot of friends. And I did. I had so many that I could name them, Marias and the Rudies and the Ruths and the Ednas, the Eddies. But they gave me a book to read. And they said, we want you to read this book. And then if you have any questions, then you talk to us. And if you don't want to ever talk to us anymore, it's all right, too. And the name of the book was The Well of Loneliness, which came out during the war, which introduced me to the fact that there were people that were different from me. And it didn't make a damn bit of difference to me. I still liked them. They were still friends. And we accepted people then. But people were more respectful of each other then, too. They respected each other's privacy. And when you had conversations, you didn't go into their... You weren't nosy. You talked about the weather, a book, a movie. What are we going to do next week? How many planes did we go this week? Or how many were shot down? Or who lost a friend or a brother? It was innocence. Mm-hmm. It really was innocence. And I think the end of innocence came after when this Second World War cleared up. That was the end of innocence because by the Korean War, there was no innocence left.
Now, so through about
44,
you were still working at Lockheed,
and 44.
Down in the final clinic, and that was
when
the skin
disease started. No, I had skin disease in 43. It started in 43, and it just inched along. As I said, that's just a burn scar, but it never goes away, and I'm wondering why. I put my arm down on the handle of a hot pan, but it's never gone away. And it doesn't bother me, so I just assume that it's just going to have to fade out. Mm-hmm. But, I had this skin disease, and it would erupt, and then it would get better, and I'd put a patch over it. At first it was just in around the arms and the hands, and then it got up here where I was exposed. Behind my ears. And I wore they had some kind of cap in that had a neck. And a bill, and you put your goggles on and then pull the bill. I don't know, I guess it was just to protect it. Some women wore bandanas, and some had their hair cut short like yours. Most of us eventually ended up with our hair cut short. That's another reason, too. They say that the women became very masculine during the war. I disagree with that, because I was one of the most feminine women that ever walked and had been all my life as far as, I guess maybe that's, I just was born feminine. But after a few months of working in the sweat and the shavings, metal shavings, do this and you dig shavings into your forehead, or you try to pull your hair up, it skip down and you try to get your hair up, and your hands filthy with chemical and little bits of metal. And you just, you know, it was like rubbing salt into a wound. So that was actually when the women really began to cut their hair short. We didn't wear earrings for a reason, obviously. We were working with tools. We didn't wear necklaces, obviously, for a reason, because when you're working with wearing metals, you can't. So we wore, I hunted and searched and explored all the boys' departments to buy boys' clothes. The jeans were sturdy. Their little shirts were made of a heavy, tough material. And the heavier and the tougher the material, I found the better for me because it kept me from getting hurt. And as I said, I would have a tendency to roll up so that I, you know, because I'm laying shoved up in the wings and in the tail section, and there's not that much room because you still have your spokes and you've got to get through them and work your arms in. And I found that by releasing my sleeves, even though I would have preferred to have them long, I could get up in there. And sometimes I had to be pulled out of those little tight places. They'd grab me by the feet and or push, or I wiggle myself in. No, I would never do this again. Ever. Ever. Never. I wouldn't care if... I just wouldn't do it. I don't think any other woman will either. They may. They may say they will. But today when you... no, I don't think so.
How did you feel about it when you were... When it came time,
at the point when you decided to quit, was that mainly because of the skin, or had you just... No, I stayed on a long time after the skin disease began, a very, very long time. And, no, I quit because I look around me on the outside and I saw people not working in aircraft, living an easy life, women... that I had known, and some that had worked and quit right away. Went in, worked 3 or 4 weeks today. This is not for me. Forget it, you know. To hell with it. In those days, too, Jen, I have to tell you this, that each community was a town in itself. Hollywood was a community. Burbank was a community. Glendale was a community. The valley was not even settled. This was not really, I mean, this was like going on a Sunday drive. You drove to the valley on a Sunday drive then. So workers, we very rarely ever met anyone that came from Long Beach or San Pedro or Huntington Beach or down Watts, or you didn't go out of the community to begin with. Workers that lived in that area, worked in that area, the shipyard workers, the steel workers, the people. There were little small plants located all over, and you never went out of your district, really, except for Lockheed Aircraft. There was Lockheed and Vega and Boeing, I think. There's another one in there somewhere. I can't remember. It's in the back of my mind, but they had special buses running. And anyone working in the defense plant, they got priority. Top priority on buses, streetcars, on buying merchandise. We got, if you worked in defense, you got extra coupons for this or that, extra shoe coupon ration or an extra gasoline ration, because if you had a car, if you were lucky enough to have a car... what sickened me and a lot of other women in 44, just before I left, was the fact that there were lots of Cadillacs or big cars in those days. I suppose they were Packards or whatever was going then. They were driving around with their A coupons. I think it was A and B and C, if I'm not mistaken. And they weren't in aircraft. And more, little by little, you begin to see, this is touchy, I don't know how to bring this up. The morale was not as strong at the end. We that were working, when we got off and on our day off and we saw our friends in the neighborhood that were not working in aircraft, oh, I know this fellow that owns this store and I can get you anything you want, or... I can get it for you wholesale, or well, why aren't you in the service, or why don't you work in aircraft? You heard stories of people buying up the Japanese properties and buying up the Japanese stores, and hordes and hordes and hordes of supplies in warehouses that you needed. Soap was rationed, butter, Kleenex, toilet paper, toothpaste, cigarettes, clothing, shoes. You couldn't really buy very good clothing. They just, you couldn't, there wasn't very much to buy to spend your money on, truthfully. Mm-hmm. You know, you could throw it away. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really, I bought suits. I paid $35, $40 a suit. My gosh, you know, it would be unheard of, but I bought good gabardine suits. I bought beautiful suits. I didn't buy that many. Mm-hmm. And I often had to wait for them. Mm-hmm. You know, or I'd go out to Beverly Hills and I'd have a tailor. He says, I can get the material for you. Then you go to my friend and have it made. Okay, it cost me twice as much. Mm-hmm. But from one friend buying the material, blackmail, or whatever they called it then, black market, and then you took this material, fine English worsted gray material, or gabardine, the materials were fabulous then. From there, you had to take it to another one, and then from there, you had to take it to another one who put it together. By the time you got through, it cost you a week's salary. But you had a beautiful suit. But you saw these people making a lot of money and not doing anything for the war effort, even bragging that I kept my son out of it. Or you meet a young man and you'd say, well, how come you're not in the service? And he'd say, oh, my father bought me out. Or, well, I have connections. And he thought, well, there's a special privileged type of people, and we're working and sweating and eating our hearts out for the casualty lists that are coming in. And then, too, are they going to see the boys coming back? That's what sickened me. I think that was, even if I had wanted to keep working in aircraft, I think I got an aversion to making anything that would hurt anybody. I think that was it. When I saw Dick tapping along that day, and the war was still on then, full blast, and I thought, my God, I mean, we used to go down to the beach, and before he went, he wasn't even in the service too long. He was sent right overseas. You know, they used to take those boys, like my brother, they sent him down to Camp Roberts, I believe, in somewhere in Northern California. And in 3 weeks, he was overseas. My brother Leroy had a little better experience. He was in the Navy, and he was in San Diego on shore leave several times, and he shipped out on long runs. But when he came back, he was in for a while. But most of the fellows that I knew by 43 were, I mean, in 3 days or in a week, they were gone. I mean, they were just gone. And then the next thing, you'd get a letter with a, not even a stamp, but with a PO from San Francisco, mostly out here, of course, because, or they were just, can't tell you where I am, but I'll see you when I come back. Or the old song that was really popular then, or I'll be seeing you. Mm-hmm. That was the, that's interesting. There was a song that was very popular during the war. It was I'll Be Seeing You. And I think everybody, you know, it was symbolic of that time. Mm-hmm. Because that was exactly, I'll be seeing you. Not when or how or where, but if, you know. So I probably wouldn't have stayed in aircraft anyway, because my skin disease got worse. Although after that I had a change of heart when I heard my brother had been injured, and I went to work for Hartman making a small part. This was individual, separate, on a small plant. And I stayed there about a week, and I said, this is no good. I can't do this. I've been too active, and I've been a racehorse on the, too long. You know, I used to run up and down that plant, and it must have been a mile long from one to another, and active, and that, I really like that type, and since then I've been active all my life. I can't sit still. But there was a disillusionment set in about 1944, toward the end.
And you think that's probably the main reason that
you left? I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was the outside influence. It was seeing people that weren't in the war effort, and weren't working 6 days, and they weren't doing this hard labor, and I don't care how you look at it, to me it wasn't that hard. The work itself, it was the conditions we had to work under. the noise and waiting for that damn buzzer or bell to ring or whatever it was, some kind of a system. And I spent my first 4 hours waiting just to get outside to get a cigarette. Oh, we couldn't smoke inside the plant. That was all right, too, because in a way it was self-discipline for me. And I said, hey, if those guys can go over there and get their guts shot out, I can go without a cigarette for 2 hours, you know. But it was when you left the plant, it was in the plant, the noise, the heat, the sweat, the aggravations, the one person would be overly ambitious because her husband was overseas, and the next one would say, I'm just here for the money. And then the next one would say, what the hell's the hurry? The war is going to last. You know, make it last. We're getting good money. And then the next one would say, well, listen, we got to win this war and get these boys back. And then they'd say, well, what are you doing? What's your interest? And I'd say, well, I don't like war. I just couldn't get it over with. You know, let's work and let's do our quota today. I used to give my, when I was training them, a little pep talk about, hey, we're sitting here and we're whole and we got, all we have to do is just a few tricks with our hands and our brain and we're going to come out whole. And then, you know, they used to pull tricks on us too. They used to have a returnee come back, or they used to show us pictures, or they'd give us a pep talk about how many soldiers were killed that day, or how many planes were shot down, or they had a projection, a screen. I don't know whether it was in the club room or a restroom or what, but they'd show, occasionally they'd show like a newsreel. And they always managed to get in there something that would spur you and drive you on to work harder. So many men killed in one day, or in this battle or that battle. Although that, your source of information then came either from the movie screen. When you went to a movie, they always had the newsreel of the happenings of the week, or a pep talk from your supervisor or your group leader, or in this little problem. Yeah, they did have, but I don't remember reading it. I think they had a little sheet they gave out every week, but no, it was subtly done. Propaganda. It was done in a way that you scarcely, hardly recognized what was happening. But I got on to that in the beginning, just as later in later years when I quit going to church, I got on to the church. When I say got on, I mean one day I suddenly realized that it's an emotional pulling. They hypnotize you, or they pull on your emotions too much. Mm-hmm. You know, some churches, really, just before they pass the collection, it's done so subtly that you hardly even realize they're doing it. But one day I sat up suddenly and I realized, my God, they're pulling on my brain. They're hypnotizing me into this, lulling me into this. And I said, I think there's more to religion than this. And I walked out and I've never been back since. And that was 20 years ago. But same thing, they did this in aircraft too. They very subtly, and they did it on the movie screens when they would pass the collection cans it was done in a very quick way so that it impressed you, but you didn't realize what was happening. And well, I went through one of the screenings though before, or just sometime during the first week I was working for Vega, we had a screening, or a character screening, or nationality. I don't know what it was. It was something, FBI, I think, or it was like a red tape thing. And it seems to me that I remember they're using this technique then. And I was very out and above, and I know everything about it, but they kind of, I have to think about it, because it impressed me at that time that this is a way you can get people to bend to you. And then later, of course, they used it they use it on television now for selling ads and selling things. But it's so quick that you have to have a second mind, or something like a third eye to get it. But they used that technique in aircraft, too, which was good because I think it kept the workers working. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken... I don't see how any woman in her right mind could have done that unless she had a tremendous sense of patriotism or in a lot of the women, I think it was a sense of urgency and desperation and what can I do in my husband's life or my son's life or, I mean, you know, it was out of desperation. And I don't mean for money because most of those women didn't even know what to do with the money. And later on we learned. It didn't take us long to learn, but in the first year, it wasn't really for the money.
Yeah.
No, even in the second year wasn't for the money. Toward the end, I think the women had become so conditioned to working. And by the way, this might, I don't know if any of your other participants have mentioned this or not, but I've kept in touch with two or three women that I worked with, and most of them have tremendous hearing problems.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them say it came from that noise.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I used to do? I used to stuff my ears with cotton.
Mm-hmm.
The noise, you know, I told you bothered me. But I'd come from a farm in a small... But I used to put cotton in my ears, and I used to wear my brother's earmuffs over my ears when I'd go, when the noise got that much, and it was noisy. But... Interestingly enough, one woman lives in Florida, and I write to, and one lives in Denver, Colorado, and I still write to her. Two have died of cancer, my age, and there's still one living in Pueblo, Colorado. See, they came from everywhere out here to work. There was a girl I worked with in Michigan. I inquired about her, and she died of cancer. Skin cancer, by the way.
Did you plan to, when you were leaving
office,
did you have plans about what
you would do? No, I still wanted to work in the war effort. In fact, I volunteered for the USO. I still felt I ought to do something to contribute. And then I reasoned with myself, well, hell, I'm buying war bonds. That's enough, and I'm... entertaining, and I'm a member of the USO, and that's enough. I'm doing my share. This was my way of getting out of it, talking myself out of it. I would never have stayed that long, as long as I did, if I hadn't been motivated by the fact that my mind, war was hell. I just, you know, I couldn't visualize war. I could visualize it, but to begin with, I never went to see a war picture. I never wanted to see anything, or I never wanted to read a newspaper. I never wanted to know what was going on. I wanted to black out from it. And I did. I mean, most people didn't really care about it. They didn't want to know about it. Maybe the older people did. But the young people, they didn't want to hear about what was happening in the war. They just wanted to know we were winning, and we were winning the war. But when it came right down to how many casualties and how many people died, and there was a church in our neighborhood over in Hollywood, and they used to put the names out every week on the front of the boys of the congregation that had died. And one of us would shake our heads. You know, one day somebody said, oh, Vince's name is on the list. And you know, I only knew these people for a couple of years, even less than a year. But in 3 months, you made a friendship, and you never forgot it. And, of course, a lot of them came back, and you resumed your friendship. But I don't think that if most women would really be truthful with you, that they enjoyed working or would have stayed in it if they hadn't really been motivated by, one, patriotism, two, actually having a member in this war, or three, some of them used it as an excuse to break out into the world. I think it was the first decent opportunity the Negro women ever had of getting out. I talked with them, and I ate with them, and I smoked with them, and I went to the bathroom with them and working. Once we were through work, there was no more sociability at all. And in fact, they were even segregated at work in a sense that the only reason I associated with them is that I hit the first exit so I could get that cigarette quicker, and they would hit the first exit because they didn't want to walk any further. And I'm being very honest with you. You can cut it out if you want. I don't care what you do with this part, but It is part, this is really, once I left work, I never socialized with them. It just, nobody, it wasn't done then.
Were they giving Mexican jobs in the
Or were scattered? They were scattered. Most of the ones, those that were capable of learning, and there were some of them that were very bright, just as bright as you or bright as me, went right on and went right into the work, and some of them just, they just couldn't learn, or they didn't have the stamina. I think a lot of it was stamina, because it was very hot, and they'd go to sleep, or they'd doze, and the whites didn't want to work with them. And that, you know, I explained to you before, that was very obvious. They had a very, very horrible body odor. Today, I notice they don't have it. I'm around them a lot. I work, it doesn't mean anything to me. The only reason then is that I'd never been around them, and I was somewhere in my teaching, I was taught that whites and blacks were to be segregated. But they just, I don't think it had the ability to learn. I don't think they'd ever really been forced to use their minds. That's the only explanation I can give you.
So your job that you worked for,
bench work. That was my last aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe what this might be a good
Period. Well, it takes me out of the war plants and out of the war, actually war time. I still maintain my patriotism, but not like before. And I really, then, well, let's get this on now. In late 44,
mm-hmm.
or actually in 44, late 43 and 44, there were rumblings about Roosevelt knowing the war and provoking the war and actually bringing on the war.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how these rumors started circulating, but began to, like a rumble, then it became a roar of, we were led into this war, we deliberately went into this war. And then they tried to rationalize, well, the Japanese attacked us. I mean, we were really attacked. We were actually, they attacked us, and then the rumblings began that Roosevelt knew this was coming, and he could have prevented it, and that he negotiated with someone to bring on this war with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That as far as Europe, they were allies. We helped them in 1918, and we had to help them, but we didn't have to send our men over. We could have sent supplies. But the rumblings, little start small, and then they become roars. So by 1944, a lot of people were questioning the war. Now, why the hell are we in it? And why? Just like they did in Vietnam and Korea. But this was more painful because, you see, we had this double guilt. We were attacked by Pearl Harbor or the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
We were fighting to defend our honor, but still, the other side, this other side I told you about, that had the Cadillacs and they were cruising, and they, I can get it for you wholesale, and they suddenly owned all the mom and pop stores, and suddenly owned all the shoe factories, and suddenly they had all the clothing you wanted, and all, you know, I mean, you could get anything you wanted if you were young and pretty and flirted with them, and had a extra coupon or so, or paid the price. It was the price, I think, more than anything, but